Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Oh, sorry, I should have asked you before. I want to make sure that I pronounce your last names correctly. So it's Matthias Dubka, right? And Fabrizio Zilibati, right?
Or Zilibati? Yes.
Yeah.
Zilibati's.
Great, thank you.
And Matthias is with a T, so it's not a TH. It's confusing.
Okay. Matthias. Matthias.
Yes, yeah.
Dubka, right? Dubka. Yeah, great.
Perfect.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Professor Matthias Dubka and Professor Fabrizio Zilibati about a wonderful book they published with Princeton University Press. The book is called Love, Money, and Parenting: How Economics Explains the Way We Raise Our Kids. Matthias and Fabrizio, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having us on.
Before we start, can you briefly introduce yourself and your field of expertise? Matthias, maybe we should start with you.
Yes. So I'm a professor of economics at London School of Economics, and I'm a macroeconomist. So we started initially working on issues related to families with interests in economic growth and development, where, of course, transmission from parents to children of human capital, of attitudes is it's important, and from that we have over time developed this research program on the economics of parenting.
I am Fabrizio Zilibati. I'm a professor of economics at Yale University. My field of expertise is similar to the one of Matthias: economic growth and development, inequality, and its causes. Among them, human development and education, transmission of culture and values within the family has become increasingly important in my agenda.
Mm. Great, thank you very much. Let's start with the book. Before coming across the book, I wasn't familiar with the term economic parenting. Can you explain what it means?
It's a good question, because it's a relatively new concept. We call it the economics of parenting because until not so long ago, most people, including academics, wouldn't have thought of parenting as being inside, the area of economics, where usually we talk of production, consumption, finance, the balance of payments, but not so much families, and certainly not parenting. And instead, parenting was mostly talked about in psychology and sociology and in other social sciences. Now, when we say the economics of parenting, what we mean is to apply the economic way of thinking to what parents do. Now, what is the economic way of thinking? We generally conceptualize human behavior as being purposeful. In economic models, we think of firms making decisions to maximize profits, of consumers making decisions to maximize their utility. We argue in the economics of parenting that the same way of thinking can actually be quite productive to understand behavior of parents. So it is the economic model of behavior apply to parents and to understand how much you can understand with that.
Can you stop again?
I think look at that. Okay, good. Mm-hmm.
And in your book, you explain different parenting style. You have authoritarian parenting style, permissive parenting style, Diana Baumrind, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, parenting style. So I'm interested to know, I know that we won't be able to get into details about each one of those, but it would be good if you could explain a couple of them with examples and give us an example how economic inequality can lead to different parenting styles.
Right. So we treat the language from child development psychology of the 1960s, especially Diana Baumrind, who introduced these notions. And we make a key distinction between these three parenting styles: authoritarian, authoritative, and permissive. So authoritarian is, the original concept, way of exercising control, essentially tell children what they have and what they cannot do, what they have to do and what they cannot do. Without necessarily explaining much and, without necessarily expressing high support or disavowing conceptually why explaining conceptually why we want this or that behavior. Authoritative parenting style, I must say, we also, make our own interpretation through the lens of our economics of parenting. So authoritative parenting style for us means to emphasize the motivational aspect. So somehow giving children the ability of performing the way parents like, also in a situation where parents do not exercise direct control, rather than limiting the behavior in a coercive way. And the permissive parenting style, which is sometimes has this word as a negative association, for us simply means a type of a parenting style that doesn't guide children in every step, let somehow children have a lot of initiative and leeway. Now, our main point is that the choice of first of all, parenting style is a choice and not a trait of individuals. It's not that some people are born authoritarian, some people are born authoritative. To some extent, that's also the case. But somehow, we think that parents choose to behave one way or another in response to the type of incentives that the environment, especially the economic environment, poses. So, coming to your question, when inequality increases, parents tend to see permissive parenting style as somehow more risky, and it becomes more important for children to succeed because the possibility of having a big success or a major failure becomes more important. And so in a society where, like in Scandinavian countries, and we take the example of equal society, there is not a big difference between the outcome when someone does well or someone does less well. Of course, parents always want children to do well, but somehow the parents leave more initiative to children, perhaps also to discover their own talent and their own vocation. In other societies, parents tend to be more obsessed about children getting good grades in school, children performing well in other activities that will open the way in admission into good schools and good universities. And that's what we associate with a more authoritative parenting style. There are some examples in the literature which are probably bordering between authoritarian and authoritative, like tiger moms or helicopter parenting, that are the typical behavior that we observe in Anglo-Saxon countries, especially in the United States, but also in different forms, also in countries like China, where inequality is also very, very important and very silent.
And let me ask another question in this different area. Why are parents spending more time with children compared to the past? This is an interesting, and I've seen it myself. I mean, I compare what I see with how I was raised. And I do see in general that parents are spending more time with their children compared to, how does economics explain this?
This is a very important observation that also motivated a lot of our work on this. And maybe just to reiterate, I think as Fabrizio was pointing out, really the key distinction between what we are doing here with the economic approach versus some of the earlier work in psychology is that we think of this as a choice as opposed to a trait. The early psychology work was about categorizing parents and looking at some data and trying to have categories of behavior. we came from a very different place where we thought about the basic idea that parenting is often managing conflict, you know, that you have maybe some different ideas than your children have. You should decide how to manage that conflict. And then we got out of our ideas that the economic environment should shape what that best way is to resolve that conflict, maybe just leave it aside, be permissive, or be maybe more interventionist through authoritative or authoritarian style. Now, if you just look at one country in one place, it's a bit hard to see the distinction, you know, between the one or the other view of is this just a fixed trait versus a choice. But these observations that you mentioned of changes in parenting over time across cohorts, these are really very important because they very much, we would argue, suggest that this behavior is not just a fixed thing of a given society, that everybody has the same thing, but there is a response to the environment. And you're completely right that in many countries, we have seen this quite impressive transformation in parenting that parents one to two generations ago used to be a lot more offhand and spend much less time interacting with their children to a modern phase where interacting with their children is very intense. And just the time that parents spend interacting with children has gone up tremendously. And, you know, all of this is, I think, for anybody working on this to some extent, a motivated own experience. And I think both Fabrizio and I, we are both also parents. I'm pretty sure Fabrizio might confirm this, a lot more intense than our parents were. You know? And so then you ask, why is that?
And something I'd like to add is the book is, little of our personal history, a little of observation across the issue, but it's also about some data that we have collected throughout our research. And one observation is that countries where inequality has grown the most are the countries where parents have increased their time spent with their children the most. So there is this kind of correlation over time. The increase in inequality started in the 1980s with an increase in the time parents spent in direct contact with their children. And we identify this turning point again in the 1980s, and that this is not, there has been no reversion, rather this trend has actually continued and strengthened over time.
Thank you for talking about that 1980s, because this is a perfect segue to my next question. And I wanted to ask that what caused that rise of inequality in the 1980s? And you go on to talk about two people, Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, and this famous hippie and yuppie debate. It would be good to talk about this.
Yes, there is a long debate in economics about what are the main factors that cause this increasing inequality. People mentioned so-called skill bias technical change, which means the type of technologies that were introduced starting in the 1980s and more so later, especially information technology, contributed to they increased the productivity of people with an education more than those without education. That in many cases were actually substituted by a machine. That's something that is coming until our days. There is the process of globalization that some point has had some role to that. Now, you mentioned this Abby Hoffman and the Jerry Rubin debate. It's something that we discuss in the book. It's like the transition from the 1960s and the early 1970s to the society that changed throughout the 1980s, 1990s, who were Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. These guys were two of the founder of the Youth International Party. They were radical activists, and the Youth International Party is one of these organization, anti-war, for freedom, against conventional attitudes that then developed into political activism. They were also a member of the. They were also two of the so-called Chicago Seven. There was a demonstration that took place in 1968 at the Democratic Convention that had a lot of impact in those days. They got first convicted and then that was canceled. So they were very well-known politically active people on the radical front. And then they took very different avenues. So Abby Hoffman continued to stay loyal to his original principle, whereas Jerry Rubin in the late 1970s and 1980s decided to change completely. He became an entrepreneur. He was one of the first financiers of Apple, and he became a millionaire. And moreover, he defended his choice as the right one. And the transformation into, you change the society through the value of education, through the effort, through your own success. And so the two of them actually continued to be friends, although they now had very different ideas. And they there was a famous series of debate in 1986 between them, which was went under the name Hippies versus Yuppies. So the Yuppies, if you remember, are it was a young urban professional that in the 1980s were symbolizing a new way of approaching life, seeking individual success, making money, and so on. And so somehow we take this parable as something, the transformation of the society, both on the side of material inequality, but also in terms of culture and values, as something that jointly has shaped the way parents deal with their children, transforming relaxed parents, almost thinking that the children have to spend most of their time on their own with their friends, which was the society where Matthias and I and many baby boomers have grown, into a society where parents spend a lot of time children, they coach them and they try to make them succeed at any cost.
When we talk about the change in inequality, I think it's useful to note that inequality is mostly economic, but doesn't have to be entirely economic. Because we are saying that parents are responding not just to economics, not just to income inequality, for example, but to the entire environment that their children face. And if you think about how does inequality or economic change really show up for parents, perhaps the most important part of that is the implications of inequality for the returns to education. Now, what's kind of really different between when I grew up and how I raise my children now? Well, that now getting a college degree, going to university, getting higher education is hugely important for success. And this has an important economic dimension, as Fabrizio mentioned, changes in information technology, maybe global trade. There's various global trends that have made these returns much higher. But it's not entirely an economic trend, because another fact that's also been observed in the United States very strongly in some other countries, that there's other forms of divergence between those with more and less education. For example, in the United States, we now see that marriage rates are much higher among those who have college education. People who do not go to college are much more likely to remain single for their lives, maybe never have any children. But of course, those are also things that that enter in your evaluation of what my children's future will be like. And so these different dimensions of inequality that, of course, are related, they all form part of that environment that parents respond to, where now parents say, for my kid to be successful, I really want them to succeed in education. Therefore, I will sit down with them, study math, study the multiplication tables, and push that forward. Whereas in the 1980s or 1970s, many parents would have said that there's many ways to success. You can go to university, you can be an apprenticeship, you can do a union job at a factory. All of those will lead to a similar middle class lifestyle. And therefore, I'll be happy to just relax more, let you have an unencumbered free childhood, and we'll just enjoy our time together without worrying too much about the future.
And the divide within society has become bigger. So there's a very nice work by Robert Putnam, for instance, and who argues that back in the 1960s, growing up in a less or more wealthy family meant something, but less than more recently. There was also much more contact between people from different socioeconomic backgrounds than there is today. So when I grew up in Italy, I had contact with the entire spectrum of the socioeconomic variation. Now many children are almost coached by their parents into even choosing the type of peers the parents approve of and those that would be more useful for their own individual success. That dimension was totally missing when I was a child. Of course, my parents would worry if I had some bad friendships in the sense that they could give me drugs or stuff like that, but not so much in terms of, stick together with the type of children who will bring you to do well in school. That was not an important dimension in those days. Mm-hmm. We have incidentally done some studies after the book precisely on this dimension, and we find very strong evidence of this type of segregation. Mm-hmm.
And I think this type of segregation that you mentioned is quite visible as well, because those people who are really wealthy, they seem to be living in a whole different society. They have their own schools in a way. They hang out with their own friends. It's like there's absolutely no interaction with the people of other classes. In terms of inequality and how it affects parenting style, how does it impact schools, children's school performance, and also risky behavior? That's another aspect of this that you discuss in the book.
So we do find evidence that these more interventionist parenting styles in some narrow sense work. So the theory is that parents are pushing harder, they're turning authoritative, they're spending all this time because they worry about school performance. And we certainly do see evidence that parents who are, say, in the authoritative group as opposed to the permissive group, that their children, for example, have higher test scores and have a higher probability of graduating, moving on to college and getting a college degree at some point. We looked at this in various data sets in a number of countries. We also, for example, looked at social mobility. So this is something we can do, again, in different countries. In the UK, for example, we found that if you look at kind of long-distance social mobility, meaning the probability of going from a, say, working-class background to kind of the very top where you are a manager or have a PhD degree, we find that the probability of those transitions is very highly correlated with the parenting style. That is a lot more likely if your parents are authoritative. It's almost impossible if the parents are authoritarian, for example. So there's a sense in which this behavior of the parents, is designed to achieve a certain thing, and it does achieve that thing. Of course, that leaves open the question, is there something else that you might get less of? Are there some costs to be paid? There's certainly cost to be paid in terms of effort. It's hard work for the parents to do this. It's probably also hard work for the kids to work so much harder. My own oldest son is now in high school, and he's working much, much harder and partying a lot less than I did at that age. Good for his school, maybe not so good for his life. I don't know, but this is a world he lives in now. But a bit more seriously, I think there's a real question also about mental health. There's observations now about a rising anxiety, kind of rising incidence of depression among teenagers. This evidence is not conclusive. It's hard to measure these things over time. It is not easy to assign a causality, but there's certainly, a reasonable probability that this additional pressure that children face also has downsides. Again, it doesn't mean that the parents are doing it wrong, because in economics, everything is a trade-off. You trade off success versus the effort that takes you there. If the downside of that mechanism is very dire, you're going to be willing to tolerate a certain amount of stress. But I think these downsides are there, and it's something that we should point out, that we do discuss in the book.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. When the book came out, that caused some even confusion, because, typically authors do some advocacy, either of a very interventionist parenting style, or to the opposite, free-range parenting. And our book says, well, the evidence shows that parenting styles matter for academic success. And so somehow is individually rational. So people follow, they do what the incentive society provide induces them to do. But at the same time, we think that the whole mechanism that has been generated is somehow irrational, in the sense that it ends with creating this big race for success in, you know, in sending a lot of signaling, spending hours in doing activities just for the sake of you know, showing in some CV that those activities were done at the expenses of other dimension of child development. And we think that this is really potentially very harmful for society. So we don't say that parents should turn to you know, a less interventionist style. We say that somehow institutions should probably adjust in a way to induce parents to relax, and also children to relax.
Mm-hmm. And how about the way parents behave in terms of being strict or liberal, and how it kind of differs in different countries? Because you discuss different case studies from around the world to discuss this issue.
Right. Yes. I mean, as I briefly mentioned before, the Scandinavian countries, countries where income distribution is most equal, and also some studies have shown that they have a relatively high social mobility. But they are countries where the extent of success or failure is somehow less consequential than for a child growing up in the United States or even more in a country like China. So we observe a systematic relationship between the extent of income inequality and the extent to which parents are, you know, intensive being, you know, either authoritarian or authoritative. So for instance, in a country like Sweden, according to our classification, but we do it by several measures, about 80% of parents are categorized as permissive by, you know, given the way they respond to questions that are asked across the globe through the World Value Survey. So people are asked the same questions about child rearing in different countries. And then based on those answers, we classify parents as, you know, according to the three parenting styles we discussed. And so in Sweden, as many as 80% are permissive, and a mere 20% are either authoritative or authoritarian. And it's the opposite is true in the United States. As few as 20% of parents are permissive. And this is not just Sweden and the United States. You know, if you take the entire spectrum of countries across income inequality, you find a very high correlation between the level of income inequality and the propensity of parents to be permissive or intensive. Now, another interesting observation is that other factors like, you know, the return to education or the extent of social policy also matters. So in countries where there is a more stronger state, a stronger role of the state in providing safety nets through welfare state institutions, then parents tend to be more relaxed and more permissive. And so we also see that the change in this institution correlates with the change in the behavior of parents. So we somehow come to the conclusion that it's not so much, or certainly not only, a matter of tradition and culture. It's something that depends on the institutional context and on how this evolves over time. So we, you know, in the end, cultural factor, as in some of the old tradition, may also have a role, but we see that this institutional aspect, economic aspects, are really important in shaping the way parents deal with their children.
Given that you were asking about strictness, I think another interesting application is to ask what is the exact way in which I intervene. So Fabrizio has outlined that inequality means you want to intervene more, either authoritarian or authoritative. But which of these ways do you want to engage in? Now, where authoritarian means I essentially emphasize obedience. Now, I, the parent, tell the child exactly what to do. I won't explain why. I just expect you follow my example. If you don't, I might punish you. And this authoritarian parenting style used to be the norm around the world. And most societies in the past had authoritarian parenting as an ideal, you know, that you had, should have a strong family, often a strong father, really setting down the rules without explaining much of what was going on, which is different from the authoritative style, which is really more about explaining why you think a child should do something. It's a bit more like indoctrination, where you try to get your child to adopt your adult values and try to get the child to understand why working hard for school, for example, is a good idea. For example, by explaining how schooling matters for going to university, now the university matters for your future. So it's a different style where you interact more, where you explain a lot more about what's going on. And again, you might think this is just culture, or this is that people have become more enlightened. But we argue in the book this is also something that you can understand in economic terms. Because if you want to ask under which conditions can authoritarian parenting be successful, well, the first thing you would need for authoritarian parenting to be successful is that you would need to have control. It only works if the parent is actually around and is able to exert the direct control. So if your children are gone there somewhere else, it's going to be much harder to be authoritarian because you're not there to supervise and to punish, to impose your will on the child. It will also require knowledge. It will require that the parent actually knows what is the right thing to do. This is, for example, a lot more likely if you have low social mobility, where the children will, by and large, do the same job, have the same occupation as the parent does. So if you're in an immobile society where children, say, tend to stay at home, say, inherit the family farm, do the same job, where different generations live together, where this control is possible, it is a lot more feasible to be authoritarian. It might be the right choice to make if the stakes are very high, bad things can happen when the children deviate, and the parents have this direct control, also the knowledge to impose their will. But this will not work if you're in a society where you have a lot of mobility, both in terms of occupation and jobs, where children do very different things than the parents do, and also where there's more geographical mobility, where children move somewhere else. So many high-income societies now, it's very unlikely that the children will have the same job as the parent. Even if they have the same job, they will learn their skills maybe at university out of the direct control of their parents. So for them to work hard, the only option is to indoctrinate them to really absorb those values themselves. So you have to do a different style because the economic conditions that you're operating in have changed. And so beyond this inequality dimension, you can also think of this dimension of being in a society with low social mobility, people stay in the same place, different generations live together, generating one parenting style very different from one in a more mobile society where parents and children are more separated, and so they have used different strategies to get what they want.
And there's another expression in the book, a parenting trap. What does that mean, and what are some of the policies we can implement to address this?
Right. One of the consequences of this stronger intervention of parents is that family background matters more and more. And so it acts as a barrier against social mobility. Horace Mann said school is the great equalizer. And I would add family is almost like the opposite. So, well, of course, family is very important. The support of the family is a great asset for children. But when parents can provide different level of support because of the different socioeconomic condition, that becomes also a factor that perpetuates instead inequality. In a world where all parents are somehow relaxed, it's also easier for those parents who may have less time in the first place, a lower level of education themselves, and in general, less access to information and other channels. It may be easier for them to provide about the same level of education as or the same level of parental input, let's say, that the richer kids have access to. But in the moment in which you start this race for doing great, building your cards for admission to to the best schools in the nation, and you know, doing all the extracurricular activities that are so popular in like in the United States, for instance. Now this become very hard for the less wealthy, and we see that, you know, if you look, for instance, at the response in terms of time spent with children, parents with college education tend to increase over time the time they spend with their children much more than the less educated parents. And we interpret that as some type of giving up. So at some point, it becomes almost impossible for them to aspire to get to the high rank of society. We also observe that it's really hard in the data to move up. And then the response is to be less active, in some cases to just protect their children from the worst consequences of you know, negative peer associations, negative the most negative effects. And somehow this means that the society future will be even more unequal, and this will continue, and you know, it's like a spiral in which society becomes even more unequal, and the condition and then the upbringing that different children have becomes more unequal over time. So we talk about this as you know, parenting traps. So parents, the more so the middle class parents, the wealthier parents engage in this race, and those who are left behind somehow renounce.
Mm. And what is the role of religion and political ideology in parenting style?
Well, if I may take this again, as Matthias said, we don't argue in the book that it's only economic incentives that matter. We think incentives is it's a broader category, and economic incentives are important, but somehow there are some primitive values that people have that may induce them to believe that the future of their children hinges on this or on that. And religious parents, and here I don't mean parents who believe in God generically, you know, the main distinction in the data is very fervent parents, you know, parents who think that religion is a very important aspect of their life versus the rest. Typically think that following a certain lifestyle is really important, even for some type of eternal life outcome. So we see that these parents, according to the logic of our argument, would be more authoritarian because they would emphasize the fact that children have to behave according to certain codes. They should do this. Things in a certain way, and in fact, we do see that there is an association between, strict religiosity and authoritarian parenting style. A bit of the same, but somewhat weaker, is true for political ideology. So, you know, conservatism tends to be associated both with religion and with more authoritarian parenting style. I would say that there the pattern is a little more tenuous, but it's still present. And again, we think that, you know, this is in line with our view that parents ultimately have a common goal, which is to make their children happy. But they may differ in the view about what this requires, and especially in what being happy means. So we have this chapter in which we look at how economic factors and also ideological factors, religious factors may all matter, interact, and somehow shape the outcomes.
I think an interesting thing about religion is that as economists, we don't even think of religion as completely outside of this process. You know, religion is not set in stone. Well, in some cases, you know, some parts of it are set in stone, but religion also changes with society. You know, and so some of the forces that change society ultimately show up in changes in religious practice. Of course, there's been many, you know, reformations and changes in teachings. There have also been more gradual changes. If you think, for example, of the role of women in religion, you know, that has changed tremendously. You know, not completely, but for example, in many Christian churches, women have now a very different role and position that they had a few hundred years ago. So some of these same changes that we argue link economics to parenting, also link economics to change in religion. Having said that, religion, you know, being culturally prescribed and having kind of its own process is something that's going to change very slowly. And so a different way of thinking of that is that religion will sometimes prescribe parenting practices that are shaped by an economic reality that is in the past. Now, I've talked about how in a less mobile society, in a society where parents and children live together and have similar roles, there's going to be more room for authoritarian parenting. If religions for many centuries develop in that kind of environment, it's not surprising that religious concept of parenting tend to be, you know, from today's perspective, a bit more conservative and a bit more emphasizing authoritarian parenting than what is common today, because to some extent they were shaped in the past. And so we can, one aspect of religion is also to think of this as a force in society that at least slows down some of these broader changes that economic change brings to the family.
And what about the is there a correlation between economic prosperity and the size of a family in terms of how many children we have? And the reason I ask, I had four siblings, actually, four other siblings. One of them passed away when I was a kid. And then I'm originally from Iran myself, and I moved to Australia. And sometimes my wife and I see parents here who have three or four children, which I found surprising myself. But then we said, maybe it's because of economic prosperity that is here. But is there a correlation in general?
There's a correlation. The problem is it changes all the time. You know, and that is a very interesting part of economics, because in the past, the correlation was positive. You know, richer places, prosperous places had more children. Sort of the basic observations back in Adam Smith, you know, that you can measure the prosperity of a place by the plentifulness of its people. You know, if there's more people, that means there's more food. People do better. That was also true across families. You know? So wealthy families, successful families used to have many children. It was a sign of success to have many children and the large family. And this all changed in the course of the, what we call the demographic transition. So starting in France, then England, then the United States, countries switched from these very large families to having smaller families. And with that came a change in that relationship between income and fertility. And so the richer families now had just two or three children as opposed to five, six, or seven. Now, the predominant explanation for this has been what we call the quantity-quality trade-off. So the idea that parents have fewer children because they want to invest a lot in their children. They want to invest in their education. They don't care so much about having five, six children. They want to care. They want to have a couple of children who do really well and maybe go to university, maybe become entrepreneurs, maybe become doctors, have success in life, which is now measured by education. And having mentioned that, you can see that some of these same forces that we have been emphasizing for parenting more recently, so I say higher returns to education, have also played a large role in this, what we call the fertility transition, this big transformation from big to small families. Now, this process of more education for children and smaller families has played out essentially in the same way in every country that has grown successfully. It was true in European countries 150 years ago, was true very strongly so in East Asian countries after World War II, in Korea, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, in Japan. And it also happened at a very rapid pace in many other Asian countries. You mentioned Iran, Bangladesh, and India, you know, were some of the highest fertility countries. But I started working on fertility. Now, typical families there also have just two children. So it's a quite dramatic transformation. This has been going on in many places, and then it kind of became more flat, you know. So for many years, many countries had around two children per family. Right now, we are in a very interesting phase again, because we are again in the phase where fertility is declining in a yet more dramatic way. So most recently, we have seen numbers from Korea, where the average number of children is now below one. You know, so it's not just one per family, as in China under the one-child policy, it's even less. So implying a very rapid shrinking of the population. And many other countries are headed in the same direction. You know? And so this ultra-low fertility is an important challenge. I would say it's not fully understood, but it certainly makes sense to think that there is a link between this very demanding, intensive parenting that we see now and fertility going even lower than before. It is perhaps no accident that South Korea, which is one of the lowest fertility rates right now, is also one of the most intensive parenting cultures where parents work extremely hard to push the children ahead, where most kids go to cramming school at night after a regular school in the afternoon, where this pressure is very palpable. And I think many parents feel they cannot afford even a second child because they want to, they feel they have to invest so much.
Incidentally, our book has had a great success in China, partly because, you know, what Matthias is pointing, he talked about Korea. Actually, we're also selling it in Korean language. But in China, parents are very worried about this, all these things. You know, they realize that, you know, this is the way success is achieved now. And at the same time, there is a lot of distress about it. So there is a lot of concern. And so parents were really, you know, when we presented the book there, were really asking a lot of questions about this, you know, about does this really make sense? Should I continue to do it? But what if I don't do it? So it felt like for them, this was really a direct experience, this tension between do I want to make the life of my child miserable or should I relax? But then it could be at the expense of my child's future.
What about the social values? How do parents teach their children different social values based on their social class? And I think we just touched upon that a few minutes ago when we were talking about mobility.
Right. Yes. I mean, this is, of course, a complex relationship. You know, when parents are, when we look at the upper classes, there has always been a mixture of, being self-assured, but also having some sense of paternalistic responsibility versus the poor. And the middle class has always been more geared towards individualism. Matthias and I made a study specifically about how this shaped up socioeconomic transformation at the time of the British Industrial Revolution, where we have this aristocracy that was very, very powerful economically by you know, the income inequality was very high in those days because it was related to land ownership. And on the one hand, there was disdain of labor and effort, but also at the same time, a sense of responsibility for the poor, which was part of the traditional value of the of that society. And then there was a middle class that was where the individual success, what we take as a, you know, we study specifically the behavior of the children of artisans. And these people knew that they could make a great economic success by you know, setting up a factory at some point, hiring other people. And that was one of the driver of the process of the cultural revolution, which is, you know, something that you know, thinkers like Max Weber have emphasized in the past. And so you know, coming from this, so you know, there was this different set of values that were taught by this middle class and the upper class or the lower class to the opposite, where somehow there was a sense of, you know, impossibility of achieving anything. And I guess this continues to these days. You know, we have these days, like in the United States, this big divide between somehow very wealthy people who feel a sense of responsibility also for the less wealthy, but then we have people who are like in the lower middle class who feel that they are increasingly dispossessed relatively to the richest, and somehow feel the pressure of the of other social group that they view as somehow even less fortunate than themselves. And I believe this is important in the type of transmission of values that that operates, and the type of you know, how much should you care for the others, how much should you care for yourself. And so there is all this debate in psychology and economics about how much we care for the others as opposed to ourselves, or how much selfish versus altruistic we are, which I think it's important, but sometimes it tends to emphasize that some people are selfish and others are altruistic, or the humans in general are selfish or human are altruistic, depending on which thinkers you are. And we think that this is somehow shaped by incentives. And, you know, in a society in which you can at some point afford to retain the economic power with some sharing, you will see people that do that. But then those who are falling behind are often the those who react most aggressively against that. And these values get also passed through to children.
And this is a hypothetical question based on you've done a lot of research in this area. You've studied things historically. Based on current economic situations around the world, there's some uncertainty with wars going on, recession, and the impacts of global pandemic. How do you see a major shift in parenting style in the next two or three decades?
So we talk about in the book that the way to predict that would be to look at the economic trends. Now, if the economic trends continue in the same way that returns to education keep increasing, for example, then we would not expect that there is a change in parenting style. At the same time, another important aspect of everything we do is that it's economics, but it's also institutions. It matters how you organize the school system. It matters how you set up education finance. It matters what redistribution of policies you have. So the society can decide to choose a different system that gives you a different outcome. This is why we have so different outcomes in, say, United States versus China versus Sweden, because these are all places subject to the same global economic trends, but with very different institutions. And so I think the question is, do enough people adopt this view, you know, that what we have gotten ourselves into is not a good situation? It is not great for the children to be under so much stress. It's also not great for the parents to be under so much pressure all the time in their parenting, as opposed to just enjoying time with children together. Are there going to be enough people with this awareness that they demand change to institutions and to how we organize our society and how we organize childhood? I think we see some of this happening. In fact, I mentioned China, well, it's a dictatorship, but in China, you know, they have already passed some laws that, for example, make some of these cramming schools illegal. I think realizing the enormous pressure that has built up there and feeling they had to do something about that. We see this sometimes at the local level, you know, where in the United States, there's examples of schools, the high school districts banding together and kind of demanding that, say, homework has to be reduced to reduce the pressure. So there's certainly, I think, examples of parents and people more generally becoming aware that we may have gotten into a bad situation that we have to do something about. So on purely economic terms, I think the trends are going still in the same direction. I think if you want to be hopeful for a very different and maybe more relaxed outcome in the future, which is what I had as a child, which Fabrizio as a child, which I think we both enjoyed very much, I think what you have to hope for is institutional change.
Mm. Yeah, I want to add one thing. You know, in the book, we always emphasize that this excessive presence of parents come at a cost. And that cost may be, you know, the ability of the child to really develop the inner talent that parents may not know about. And, you know, if you're, you know, make the family example. My brother-in-law is a successful painter, but it's not the parents were especially happy when he took that path because they thought it was going to be a dangerous one. In the end, he persisted and he's doing well. You know, so when we think about permissive parenting here, we don't think of absentee parents. We think that parents let somehow their children develop at their speed. Now, one of the development that I see in society with artificial intelligence is somehow many of the codifiable tasks and more also the cognitive tasks that, you know, very soon, possibly also the way we teach our subject, including economics, you know, the ability to be, you know, a smart programmer at different levels. Well, all of this may be taken over by machines. So far, we have thought about, you know, robots taking the place of people and so substituting for manual work. But then more and more, this has moved towards non-manual activities, and is coming also to more academic and intellectual activities. So it might be that what we need for the future is really to strengthen the ability of people to be innovative, and so to be able of having new ideas, as opposed to being quick at putting together things because the machine is doing that very well. So in that situation, too much parenting may actually backfire. And so this is a, you know, this is a moment, the final moment of this conversation is also about speculation. So we don't have, of course, any evidence about that because it's just at the beginning. But I can imagine that the society might take that direction, and maybe some of the also educational models, activities are going to change because of this.
Professor Matthias Dubka and Professor Fabrizio Zilabotti, thank you very, very much for your time to talk with us on New Books Network about your wonderful book. The book is called, the book we just discussed was called Love, Money, and Parenting, How Economics Explains the Way We Raise Our Kids, published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Morten. Thank you.